Hi, Rod Quinn, and welcome to this special podcast of the Nightlife Program. We're going to hear about three events that are happening in Australia early next year. For the first time ever, Major League Baseball official competition games will be played in Australia, and that will be at the SCG in March. We'll hear from Tom Nicholson about that. We'll also hear an exclusive interview with the legendary singer-songwriter Suzanne Vega, who has a new album out early next year and will be touring Australia in April. But first, a young performer, plucked from obscurity and set to become a star. Her name is Phoebe Panaritos, and she will play one of the leading roles in Baz Luhrmann's stage musical version of Strictly Ballroom. She joins us on Nightlife. Phoebe, good evening.
Hi, how are you going?
I'm okay, but I'm not the one headlining the biggest musical of the year. How do you feel?
I feel very excited and anxious and privileged, lots of emotions.
When you heard that Baz Luhrmann was bringing Strictly Ballroom back to the stage, because it began life as a stage show and then became this huge musical that the world fell in love with, did you ever think at that point, yeah, I'd like to be part of that?
Oh, every show that gets announced for Australia, I want to be a part of. So Strictly Ballroom was just yet another show that I'd heard was coming. Mm-hmm. And I thought, oh, here's one that I particularly think that I'm right for. But I didn't expect to get where I am now, not at all.
Okay, so how did you get from there to now, when you're only, you know, a couple of months away from opening night in a Baz Luhrmann musical? I don't want to put too much pressure on you. What happens? How does it start? Where do you mm-hmm. begin that process?
Yeah, well, I auditioned way back in April and, you know, I had a number on my chest. I think I was number 39 or something out of, I think there was 50 in my call. And that was just one call of, there was multiple calls that day, multiple auditions of 50 girls. And I went in, I auditioned, we did a dance, they cut people, and that process goes on and on and on for weeks and weeks, and they slowly cull people, and you just hope that you're going to get through and you stand out, and yeah, they notice you.
Do you know how many people, how many women went up for that role?
I don't know the exact number, but I do know they, you know, they auditioned pretty much nationally, and I know they also looked overseas as well in London and New York. So there was a fair few girls and a lot of talented girls. So I feel very lucky.
So there's 50 in your casting call.
Mm-hmm.
You're not the only lot that day. There might have been another
couple. Yeah, no, there were. Mine, a friend of mine and some other friends had different times. And yeah.
And then there's others on other days.
Yeah.
So we could be looking at potentially more than a thousand people.
Yeah, that's...
And they chose you.
It's crazy.
Did you think, hang on, there's been a mistake made here somewhere?
Oh, look, it was such a long process and there were so many auditions and so many challenges I had to face. By the end, I was so excited that I got the part, but I knew where I stood and I knew that I was liked and favoured among the people casting. So,
all right, go back to that first day then. Was Baz in the auditorium watching or was there...
Not the first day.
So his casting agent is there looking at the dancers.
Yeah, they had a panel of people. The choreographer Cha-Cha was always there.
Cha-Cha, that's a good name for a choreographer. Okay, so Cha-Cha, what do they do? Just tap you on the shoulder or say, number 51, number 39, you stay, everyone else leave?
No, you just, I mean, there's a funny story actually. When it got closer to the Scott and Fran calls and I was being considered for Fran, we all had to pair up and partner up in the audition. And me being me, I didn't really know many people in the room. I'm fairly new to the industry and I wasn't quick like most of the other girls, but I missed out on getting a partner because there was one too many girls for boys. So everyone partnered up and we learnt the Paso Doble and I had to learn the routine by myself because I didn't have a partner.
That kind of defeats the purpose of the Paso Doble, which is for two people.
So when we had our chance to do it in front of the panel, that was the first time I'd ever done it with a partner. And Cha-Cha, the choreographer, came up to me and said, you know, I know what's going on. It's okay. Don't stress out. Because I just didn't have a partner.
Yeah.
Which, looking back now, I think, oh, that's such a Fran thing to do, be the one left out.
After that first audition, though, were you auditioning for Fran? Did you know that? Or were you auditioning for whatever role was to come up or just to be part of the chorus? Because there's a lot of dancers.
Yeah, I knew I was auditioning for Fran because I was given a script to go home and read for. But, you know, you don't know what that means. You could be auditioning for the part, but you also could be auditioning for an understudy or a girl in the ensemble that maybe covered the part, or it means lots of things, yeah.
Okay, so you get through that first one, you call back. How many times were you called back before it really gets down to the pointy end?
I think I'd been called back maybe 5 times before I got to see Baz.
5 times before you even met Baz?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, and it was only about 6 girls the first time that got to see Baz.
So what's that like? How does that happen? Is he sitting in the dark auditorium and you're on the stage? It's not like the classic Broadway show?
All these things go through your mind. You're thinking, I'm having an audition with Baz Luhrmann. And I quite often had that image in my head. I'd walk into this dark, ominous room and he'd be in the corner. No, it was nothing like that. He just casually walked in and said, hey gang, how you going? And he was really personable. And he took 10 minutes to make the actors feel comfortable. Right. He has this amazing ability to make you feel really comfortable and safe, and he brings out your best work because he has that ability to make you feel comfortable.
But you're there with the other girls in line for the role?
Yeah, yeah.
How nerve-wracking was that?
Oh, I was petrified. I knew a lot of them as well because I'd seen them in shows before and they were all really talented, and I just felt so lucky to be there and be a part of that six.
But they're probably thinking the same thing about you.
Oh, I don't know. I'm pretty fresh-faced to the scene, so I don't think anyone was too worried about me in the
Anyone
beginning.
Anyone that we'd know?
Oh, I don't know. I don't think so. But, yeah, I'd definitely seen a lot of the girls in shows before.
Okay, so then that process. I'm really interested in this whole process. When it's down to six, is it then like, you know, you're the next one voted off the island? Does it go down by one, or does Baz look at you, look at all six and say, you're the one?
Yeah, everyone got a chance. Everyone got a go at the scene and the song. And, you know, we got partnered up, and I actually got partnered up with Thomas Lacey.
He's the one who plays Scott.
Yeah. So we read the scene together. And after we read the scene together for the first time in front of Baz, he said, you know, there's something here. This is very interesting. And there's something going on here. And I'm going to keep my eye on you too. And we both knew that, you know, he liked what we'd done. And then it was a process of working with him, just Thomas and I, and we don't know who else was being seen at the same time. You just don't know. You hope it's just the two of you. But
he's probably working with the others as well.
Yeah.
What's the moment like when someone tells you, who told you you've got the part?
Baz told me.
So does he ring you? Does he call you in? Tell me about that.
It was actually at ABC Studios here. I'd had a rehearsal for Strictly Ballroom, which, you know, we had this 3-week workshop, and I didn't know if I had the part, but I was workshopping for the role of Fran. I was just, every day was like an audition. It was, but I was right to the end, so I knew that they liked me, but I just had to get over the line. And we had a really good day of rehearsals, and Baz was really happy with everything that was going on. I thought, oh, today's got to be the day, you know, I don't know, but hopefully. And I was waiting outside for my dad to pick me up, and I got this call from an unknown number. And I just had this feeling it would be him. And I answered, and of course it was Baz. And he just, congratulated me on my work and, you know, said that I'd gotten the part. And he was really happy to tell me that, and that I'd fought through it all. And it was really exciting. I lost it. I was jumping up and down on the street like a crazy person.
Did he say, hello, Fran?
He said, see you tomorrow, Fran.
So that's one thing, but that's just the start of it. The hard work then really begins after that, doesn't it?
Yeah.
So what happens once you've got the role? There's no actual guarantee that you stay in the role. Maybe after, you know, who knows, a couple of weeks, Baz might think, you know what, maybe I made a mistake. Now, he's not going to say it with
not,
you,
okay.
Obviously, but what happens then?
Well, now it's, you know, full speed ahead, looking forward to rehearsals that commence on the 20th of January. But until then, they've got us doing 3 times a week. I've got a flamenco class this afternoon, so I'm doing flamenco dancing, which is totally new to me, but I'm loving it. And I'm also trying to sing every day, just keep fit in all areas, so when rehearsals start, I'm really ready to go.
Because it is a musical, so you need to be a triple threat. You need to sing, dance, and act. You topped the state in drama for the HSC in New South Wales.
Yeah.
How do you do that?
I was just a big theatre nerd in high school.
But is it written work? Do you have to then present monologues? How does it work?
You can sort of choose. Like, some people wrote their own monologues. I didn't know what I was going to do. I had no idea. And, you know, you have your drama teachers tell you, oh, you're good at being funny, or you're good at being this or whatever. And I thought, I just don't know what I want to do. And I went and saw at Sydney Theatre Company The Year of Magical Thinking with Robin Nevin. It was a one-woman play. It was brilliant. And it was about a 40-year-old woman that had lost her husband.
Yeah.
I mean, something that I totally couldn't connect with. I was like this 17-year-old girl. But I just loved it and thought it was brilliant. And I, you know, bought the play and cut it down to a 10-minute monologue and did a really dramatic piece of a woman losing her husband and, I don't know, seemed to do well.
This is based on the Joan Didion novel
book. Yeah, and I read the book and I loved it and just became completely obsessed with this story and I had to do it.
So that's for the HSC. So you do your own monologue and people then mark you.
Yeah, and then I got to perform my monologue at the Seymour Centre as a part of Onstage, which was for all the people that topped the state in drama.
So it's like the Art Express, it seems.
Yeah, it's the same.
Yeah. Who's in the audience for something like that? All the casting agents, the directors, producers and that sort of thing?
I don't really know. I think there were other school students there who were commencing their final year of year 12. I don't really know. I had been accepted into the VCA before I did on stage, so I knew I was going to Melbourne to study there for 3 years. But I don't really know what the kind of people that came. I know my family was there because I could hear them.
You're with Rod Quinn on The Nightlife. Our guest is Phoebe Panaritos. Phoebe is playing the role of Fran in Strictly Ballroom, the musical, which has its premiere, I think, the opening night on the 12th of April next year, but in previews from the 25th of March next year. Baz is, you'd have to say, notoriously secretive, and I would say quite rightly, about his projects. I would think less so with this because people know the story. What can you tell us about the stage version of Strictly Ballroom, which has been done on the stage before but nowhere near to this extent?
Yeah, it was a play first. Yeah. Look, from what we did in the workshop, which was we only worked on a small section of the show and we had some of the sets there and we worked with some of the costumes that Catherine Martin had put together and they were beautiful and amazing.
I can't imagine they would be.
I mean, just this small section of the show, which I think would have been not even 10 minutes, maybe, you know, a roundabout. But it was pretty magical. It was amazing. And all the people that were invited to see this little showing that we'd put together were just in tears and they were blown away. And I'm really excited to see what comes next. I don't know exactly because we haven't started rehearsals, but just from that little taste of in the workshop, I think Australia is something to look forward to.
So you've got basically 2 months between the 20th of January to the 25th of March to get this right.
Yeah.
Now, I'm sure you can do it, but you've got to learn the lines. Do you know all the lines?
I don't know all the lines. I haven't got my script yet.
So you don't even have a script?
No, but we did have a read-through of the script. And, yeah, I mean, lines are something that I think come through the rehearsal, you know, through working the scenes and things like that.
So you're not expected to know all your lines when you turn up for the first rehearsal?
No, I don't think off book, like you're expected to be familiar. But as soon as I get my script, I know myself I'll be honing into it a bit.
Yeah, of course. And you're dancing and you're singing. How are they?
Yeah, well, I danced all my life. Like that's how I got into theatre, really. I started off at dance school. So I went to dance school for a really long time and it was through my dance school that I discovered things like singing and acting. So dancing's really where it all began for me. And I've always kept up my dancing, but the passion for musical theatre and singing and acting and dancing, it all became like this thing that I loved doing all three so much. So music theatre was completely the right thing for me to focus on.
Okay. So you've had that script read through. After that, I mean, you're able to tell us whether there are any major differences or between the movie that people know and love and the way that it'll end up on stage?
Oh, no, the story's there, yeah. It's that won't change, no. It's the same story that Australia knew and fell in love with.
Okay. As you say, as I mentioned, they did know it. They did fall in love with it. How are you going to make them fall in love with you?
I feel like I know Fran and I know the character and I understand what her role in the story. And I hope I do it justice. And I trust Baz. I trust him completely. And I know that he will bring out the best in me like he has leading up to this moment.
Tell me also about the costumes. You mentioned Catherine Martin. She is now making these costumes for you. especially for you, to fit you.
Yeah, it's crazy.
The costumes are so important.
Yeah.
In Strictly Ballroom. Mm. What have you seen so far? Anything?
I've seen one dress I've worn, which is, you know, you can see at the moment is sort of they're using in a lot of advertising.
Right.
It's a red flamenco dress. It's beautiful. But I've never put on anything that fit me so well. It was just made completely for my body. And, you know, I have this big brown, beautiful wig and the hair and makeup. The first time they did me up as Fran, I barely could recognize myself
really?
In the mirror. I was such a dag. I couldn't believe it. She does a beautiful job.
Okay. How many songs do you have in the show?
There's all the songs, most of the songs from the original mm-hmm. movie. And there are being some original songs written as well. So there's going to be quite a few, there's a lot of singing, yeah.
Okay.
A few duets between Scott and Fran, which is nice.
Have you allowed yourself to think about opening night?
Not really. I see it as a, that's my next goal. Like I just got to get there and be confident and happy that when that day comes, I'll be ready for it. Yeah.
How long is the show planned on running? What's going to happen? There's a Sydney season and then mm-hmm. I presume it's going to go somewhere else. What do you know about what
we
else
just
is going
know
to
about Sydney. That's yeah. all that's being
But
confirmed.
People are going to come in from all over Australia to see this.
Yeah.
It's not just for people in Sydney. This
yeah.
everyone in Australia is probably going to go and
yeah.
see the show.
Yeah, that's the hope that we'll get people from all over.
So there's no limit to the season at the moment.
Well, Sydney's just been confirmed, yeah.
But, I mean, it's not like, well, it's a 12-week season. This could go on for a year.
Well, hopefully. That's the hope, I think.
Mm.
Yeah.
What else have you been in that people may have seen?
The only thing I think that people would know about would be I was in Oliver when I was 11 at the Lyric Theatre. So I'm going back to the Lyric Theatre
right.
now, you know, 12 years later. For me, I feel like it's full circle. That was my first professional musical when I was a little kid, and that's where I fell in love with musicals, and I decided that's what I wanted to do with the rest of my life. So that was Cameron McIntosh's Oliver in 2001.
And who was in that?
John Waters and Tamsin Carroll.
Okay.
Yeah, it was that was heaven for me. I had the best time of my life, and I think if it wasn't for that show, I don't know if I would have followed down this path.
So what did you play in Oliver? One of the urchins?
I was just one of the orphans. Her name was Rose.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. It was really fun.
I would be incredibly nervous going on stage. What was it like in front of all those people night after night?
I also did a show this year in Melbourne, a professional musical, Singing in the Rain, which
yep.
was with the production company. So that was really like the first time I'd been in a professional show since I was 11. And I'd been training and working all this time and went to VCA and did shows there. But that night, I remember, because I was the first person to come out on stage, and I just sort of ran around and sang a little bit. I wasn't a lead character or anything. I just had to run out and scream like a crazy fan or something. That was what my part was. And I was so nervous and excited, and everybody else in the show was quite experienced and I was new, and they all were just like, you know, thought it was so funny seeing someone so excited because I just hadn't done it before, or, you know, in a long time. But I was just like completely happy. I was almost crying. I was just so excited to get out there. I was nervous and I wasn't even doing anything that like singing a solo or anything like that, but
yeah.
It's more the adrenaline. Like it's such a high, you know, rushing out onto that stage, and yeah, it's amazing.
And also the fact, though, that Baz chose you. He's got confidence in you. He knows you can do it.
Yeah.
So that first night of Strictly Ballroom, the thing is, the premiere will be, you know, 3 weeks or so after the previews. You
mm-hmm.
know, you've been in previews for 3 weeks. All that nervousness would have gone, wouldn't it?
Oh, I think there's always a hype around opening night. And I think the magical thing about live theatre, for me anyway, is I love the fact that you've got one hand on the known, so you know your part, you know your lines, but you've also got one hand on the unknown. You don't know what could happen. Like something incredible, you don't know what could happen because it's live.
Yeah.
And I love that about theatre. So I even remember as a kid in Oliver, it was like my 70th show or something, and I'd done the role so many times, and but it was still exciting because anything could happen, and I love that.
The opening night is the 12th of April. It's in previews from the 25th of March. Phoebe, congratulations on getting the role. Break a leg as well.
Thank you.
It's going to be a fantastic opportunity, and thank you so much for coming in and telling us about it.
Thank you.
You're with Rod Quinn on The Nightlife, and we're previewing three events that are happening in Australia early next year. We've just spoken to Phoebe Panaritos, who is starring in Strictly Ballroom. Later on in the hour, we'll find out why Major League Baseball is playing a couple of competition games here in Australia. But before we get to that, one of America's great modern singer-songwriters, Suzanne Vega. She's back with a new album released early next year, and she will be touring in April next year. Suzanne Vega is with us tonight as well. Suzanne, a very good evening to you.
Good evening.
This is your first album of new music in 7 years, but you've been pretty busy re-recording your old songs, four albums worth. What's the story behind that?
Well, the story behind that is that I had a feeling I was going to be starting my own record label and putting out new records on my own label. So I wanted to test the waters by re-recording my older material and putting it out to see how we would do. I thought it was something that the fans would like because they're more intimate recordings, and it's also a way of getting the old songs out to a new audience with not their usual context. That was my reasoning.
So how do you go about choosing which ones are the songs that you're going to record? Because you kind of re-theme them with various themes. The albums are not just a collection of songs, but they are under various themes. How do you go about choosing which ones you want to do, or do you plan to re-record all of them?
Well, I've re-recorded, I think, about 70, so it's pretty much nearly all of them. I did the ones I knew the fans would like, and I did the ones that I like myself that I feel are essential. It was kind of easy.
And then what do you think when you go back and you have to, you know, re-record that earlier work? Do you think, oh, I made a mistake there, or boy, I really nailed it, or I can just fix this little thing up?
Most of the time when I go back and re-record, I don't fix anything. Some songs are just beyond fixing. they just, usually after the cooling off period, it's really, I can't go back and change it or tweak it. But it was fun rediscovering some of the songs. A song like If You Were In My Movie, I thought that was really kind of groovy what we did with it. I liked the new version of it.
And I presume you don't actually go back and listen to your old albums, but you've got to listen to your old music all the time in a way because you've played the songs on stage.
There are times where I listen to them mostly for reference. It's not, I don't sit around the house and listen to myself. it doesn't happen that way. But Jerry Leonard, who's my musical director, and I will often go back and reference something if we need to hear how it was put down on album.
And to relearn the words?
To relearn the words, to relearn the melodies, to relearn the arrangements. And especially sometimes we'll do that if we're working a song back into the set, because I tour a lot, so we're always changing the set list.
The new album, Tales from the Realm of the Queen of Pentacles, is one of the great album titles of all time.
Oh, gosh, thanks.
Don't you think? I think it's fantastic, and it really gives people an idea of what the album's going to be like.
Oh, good. I'm so glad you said that, because I wasn't sure whether people would think it was pretentious or, you know, long and overly fanciful. But I really do think it's true. I think I tried to be as straightforward as I could, and I think it does give people a sense of what the album's like. You know, 10 songs that tell these stories about archetypes from, you know, another world, in a sense.
And I love that aspect, because it starts with that first song, Crack in the Wall, where there is this little crack, and you go through it, and it literally leads you, or leads the listener, into your world, or into another world.
Yes, I did that on purpose, and I'm so glad you noticed that. I wanted it to tell a story. You know, you go, it's a bit like Alice in Wonderland, or any of those fantasy novels. You kind of, you slip through the wall, and you find yourself in a kind of magic land where anything can happen. And then it also ends on that note of having the horizon beyond this one. It's very satisfying, I must say. I'm happy with the way it all turned out.
And also with that first song, there's a real kind of Bob Dylan feel to that song. It's certainly totally Suzanne Vega, but the music, to me, there's that touch of Dylan.
Well, we actually were really lucky in getting to work with the guy who's worked with Bob Dylan for so many years, Larry Campbell. He put mandolin, he put banjo, he put all kinds of beautiful sort of Americana string sounds on all through the album. So there's a bit of that. But also I love Dylan as a songwriter, so yeah. I'll soak up whatever I can from him.
And then we're into the rest of the album, and because you would guess, I suppose, from the title of the record, that there's kind of a tarot theme through a couple of the songs, and you cast yourself, or the person in that one of the songs, is the Fool.
Yes, yes.
Is that you?
Yeah, it's true. I kind of feel that, well, first of all, the Fool in the tarot deck is a special character. He's the first one, and he's the one to whom all stories happen. And the Fool is a character not only in tarot, but in all kinds of folk tales. There's the kind of simpleton, even in Charles Dickens, there's kind of the simple guy, sometimes an androgynous figure, to whom all things happen. And I identify with that character a lot. I always feel like I'm optimistic, but don't always think things through, and I'm so bad at forecasting the future. Yeah, so that's my story. I identify with that.
And yet, to me, the rest of the album is very dark in places. It addresses all sorts of kind of very serious themes, whether it be kind of a slight return to child abuse that people may know with a song like Luca, but also there's a lot about death. And then the song I Never Wear White, which I think is, you know, the strongest song on the record. It's an amazing song.
Oh, thank you. Well, that one just came out kind of on its own, almost. I was looking at my wardrobe one day and thinking, you know, I just feel more comfortable in black, and here's why. So that was my explanation of it. Yeah, it's dark in spots, but also has, I think, a nice light that comes through all of it.
Suzanne Vega and I Never Wear White from her new album, which will be out next year. It's called Tales from the Realm of the Queen of Pentacles. Suzanne Vega is our guest on Nightlife tonight. And if you like Suzanne Vega, you will love the album. She has such a distinctive voice. But there's a real diversity with the musical styles on this album. In fact, one of the songs, Laying On of Hands, really sounds like a psychedelic song from the 1960s.
Yeah, well, it has that feeling. We were listening to the Beatles, Lady Madonna, and we were also thinking of the Stones, Sympathy for the Devil, you know, the conga parts. So we just kind of let our imaginations go. We had a lot of wide references for this album.
And also, you know, with I Never Wear White, I'd kind of get a feeling of kind of a folky Nirvana in there as well. There's the use of electric guitars, which again, people may not necessarily associate with you. That's really strong on the record as well.
That's pretty much Jerry Leonard's work. I didn't feel any need to put anything else on it. There's no acoustic guitar or anything. It's a very, very simple track. Jerry on guitar, Tony Levin on bass, and Jay Bellrose on drums. And that's it. And me on vocals. So that's all that electric guitar, that's Jerry Leonard. Mm. So it was something that just kind of flowed out. I said, I need a really dirty sounding riff for this lyric. He went, oh, like this? And he played it. And I said, yeah, exactly right. So that song took about 5 minutes to put together.
And then there's kind of dips into the Bible, and there's dips into Greek mythology as well. I presume this inspiration you'll take from anywhere that you can get it.
Yeah, exactly. I go with whatever sets my imagination on fire. And I sort of cast my net sort of far and wide.
And that includes death. And there's a couple of songs about either death or looking back over a long life. And there's a great line in it about more years have gone by than are ahead. Is that how you feel as well?
I do feel that way sometimes. Not in a bad way. I feel I've had a really good life. And I'm also at that age where, you know, people that I knew growing up are you know, just more of it around me. But there's also, fortunately, marriages and births also, so it's not just all death. It's the way it's life. It's the way life is.
Recently, Lou Reed died. And what did he mean to you? Tell me about the concert you went to when you saw him for the first time.
Oh, that was amazing. He was playing at Columbia University when I was going to Barnard College there. I was so intrigued by his songwriting, and I felt that he really told the truth in a very plain way that I'd never really heard before. And it really altered my way of thinking about songs. And in his later years, I got to know him more and be friends with him, and I played him some new material. And I felt very lucky and very privileged to be part of his life in any way.
What was he really like, given that he had such an unusual kind of stage presence? What was he like when you were just talking to him as a friend?
Well, the surprising thing is that he could be very tender and very sweet, which you wouldn't expect. We had an episode once where I was over at his house, and he had a swimming pool in the backyard, and I was swimming in the pool, and his puppy, he had a dog, who got my sunglasses, picked them up and ran to the other side of the yard and started chewing on them. And I was afraid that the dog was going to hurt his mouth because he's chewing up my glasses. And Lou was so sweet about it, and he just kept saying, "Oh, I'm so sorry that the dog, you know, chewed up your glasses, and can I get you a new pair? And, you know, I'll take them over right now, and we'll get them fixed." And it was kind of shocking. I said, "Forget about it. You know, I'll take care of it." And mostly I was just happy that the dog's mouth wasn't hurt. And, you know, the dog was a puppy. Didn't know any better. So that was something I just found really, really striking, how kind he could be.
I think the idea of Lou Reed with a swimming pool is the really bizarre idea.
Well, he definitely had one. He and Laurie have a swimming pool. Yeah. In the country house there. And I know what you mean, though. The first few times I saw them there, it just seemed so wholesome and healthy. I couldn't really believe it. You know, to see him on a bicycle or something just seemed like the weirdest thing. But it was great to be part of his life.
You toured here not that long ago, only a couple of years ago, and you're touring again in 2014 to Australia. What can people expect as a 2014 Suzanne Vega show?
Well, lately I've been touring with just myself and Jerry Leonard on guitar. Jerry's the producer of the new album, but he's more than just a guitar player. He really, he can be a whole production in and of himself. Hopefully we'll also be able to bring a drummer, Doug Yoel. We'll do probably a combination of things, but we're working on the set list now. So it'll be a full sound and a lot of the new stuff, but also a lot of the older material also.
And one of the things that I loved when I saw you last time was after the concert, where you took the time to sit and talk to anyone who was at the show who wanted to talk to you or get something signed. Is that something that you would do usually, or why is it that you do it and so many other artists don't?
Well, I do it if I can. I suppose if it became a thing where I was spending hours doing it after every show, I suppose I wouldn't be able to do it. But I'm happy to do it. I like to see who's there. I like to look people in the face and see what's going on. You know, I get a sense of who's out there. And it's great. Sometimes I'll see little kids who come and I'll say, how did you find out about my music? And they'll say, "Oh, I heard you on the radio, and I told my mom, we need to go see her." So you never know who's out there, so I like to go out and see.
Can I also ask you about a concert when you were 12 years old where you performed with Pete Seeger? What happened? How did that come about?
Oh, that was great. He came to my school to do a benefit for my school. I went to a sort of hippie progressive school back in the 70s. And he came to our school, and he picked out a group of children to sit at his feet. And I was so excited that he was at our school, and I really, really wanted to be picked. And I stood very close to him, and I sang really loudly. I think it was Guantanamera. And he did pick me, and he picked my sister also, and a group of 12 kids. And we sat at his feet at Carnegie Hall, and we sang along with him, and it was thrilling. And it made me want to continue doing it for the rest of my life.
Your most famous song is Luca. I think one of the great performances of all time was at the Grammys, where it was just you and your guitar singing that song. It's just so beautiful.
Thank you.
And the story of the song is an interesting one, because the real Luca was not an abused child.
He was just a boy who lived in my building.
Yeah.
He did come back years later with a girl and came to my old apartment and said to my old roommate, he said, "Could you tell this girl that Suzanne Vega really did live here?" So he figured out that I had lived downstairs from him and that he was the one I had based the song on. And I think he was sort of using it to impress his girlfriend, which I'm relieved about, you know, because he could have been angry that that I'd taken his name and put it in the song. That's the last time I've heard from him.
I'm really looking forward to next year. Suzanne, thank you so much, and congratulations on a great, great new album.
Thanks so much. I really appreciate it. Thank you very much.
Suzanne Vega. And Suzanne Vega's tour of Australia begins in Perth on the 11th of April. She then travels to Cairns on the 13th of April, plays at Blues Fest at Byron Bay on the 17th and 18th of April, before playing in Melbourne on the 19th, and then in Sydney on the 20th of April, 2014. Here with Rod Quinn, this is The Nightlife. Now, it's not unusual, perhaps, for a major music star like Suzanne Vega to play in Australia. What is unusual is that two Major League Baseball teams are coming here, and not just for exhibition matches, for actual competition games. It's happening at the Sydney Cricket Ground in March. And what many people may not know is that Major League Baseball, which is the organization that runs the World Series and all the major competitions in the United States, actually has an office in Australia. One of the people running it is Tom Nicholson. Tom, a very good evening to you.
Rod, thank you. It's great to be here.
Tell me, what is Major League Baseball doing in Australia?
Well, it's Major League Baseball. We've had a presence here since the early 90s. It is all part of a strategic plan as far as growing the game internationally. We've got offices in London, Tokyo, Beijing, here in Australia. My role is really to look after the Oceania region, which probably the two front runners is New Zealand and Australia.
So it's a major sport in the United States, in Canada, Japan, couple of Asian countries, but you'd have to say a minor sport in other countries.
Oh, it's huge in South America,
right?
Throughout Asia, even here in Australia, the roots of baseball go all the way back to the Gold Rush in Victoria. So that was the 1850s, and we've had a presence throughout history here in Australia. The sporting landscape is very, very competitive. And yet, over the course of the years, we've had a lot of cricketers, famous cricketers that have played baseball.
Ian Chappell, Norm O'Neill.
Exactly.
Alan Border. Alan Border, of course, very much so. So what's the plan then for Major League Baseball? Do you want to discover players and take them to America? Or do you want to see, you know, there is a major Australian baseball league, and the Canberra Cavalry do very well, and in fact are the Asian champions now. What would you like to see happen with that?
It is part of the growth of the game. We have a couple of touch points across the globe that, yes, it is about getting players signing professionally, getting them involved in the U.S., the major leagues. It is the pinnacle of the sport. So it is part of that pathway. But isolating and looking here at Australia, we are looked upon as a bit of a laboratory. We've only got 22 million people here, but we develop a concept here. And let me give you an example. We started the Baseball Academy just after the 2000 Olympics. So we experimented with this concept. It is now the flagship that we've rolled out in other parts of the world. We've signed 202 Australian professionals just out of this academy. Remarkable numbers. They're all part of either the system or have gone through the system and are now playing back here in Australia. Give you an example, Brad Harmon. He's on the Australian team. He's a shortstop with the Melbourne Aces. He plays in the Australian Baseball League. But he's gone through the ranks, the pathway. Yeah, I think it was with the Philadelphia Phillies. Saw some time at the major league level. Now he's come back.
So is that the dream then, is to develop the players here, let them go to play Major League Baseball, make some kind of a name, and then come back to help grow the game in Australia?
That's part of the snapshot, yes. It's trying to enhance the career path for our Australians, very much so. And it's an exciting pathway because it is global. It's international platform. You get testimonial comments from these players. It really is a global game. And we're trying to enhance that through that pathway.
So what role does Major League Baseball, the American baseball competition, have with the Australian Baseball League? Do you own it? Do you control it? How does it work?
Again, this is probably a little bit of an experiment. We run the Major League Baseball, the whole competition, the minor leagues in the U.S. But outside the U.S., this is a bit of an experiment. We've invested 75% ownership in the Australian Baseball League. We saw this as a pivotal role for us when you look at that pathway. In other words, we're involved in grassroots, the Aussie T-ball through the schools. Little League now, Australia has direct representation to Little League in Williamsport, Pennsylvania every year now. The first one was just this past August. Then you look at the national competition where we then take the cream of the crop to the academy. We'll skill them up both academically and on the field. Two career paths out of there. Some will go to U.S. colleges where you can still play the game and get an academic degree, tertiary degree, and then others will take the professional path. The final link, though, was having that Australian Baseball League to gain that exposure. Overall, it's showcasing our best to the Australian public right here in the marketplace. So it's a key. And as you said, Canberra now winning the Asia the series.
Yeah.
Heck, we've never won a game, let alone the series before. And it's just a tremendous track record that we're seeing here.
How did they do it?
You know what? It's part of tournament play. Anything can happen. You have to have things working in sync. You got to have good pitching. You got to have key hits at the right time. And that's playing the game as the Asia countries do. They play tournament play so well. Japan, for instance, has won the World Baseball Classic 2 out of the last 3 series. So it is a powerhouse. And to have Canberra come through like they did, wow, that's a Cinderella story.
How many Australians currently play in major league team in the actual major league baseball?
Well, I would say 18 months ago we had as many as 10.
Right.
Understand that it fluctuates.
Sure.
Even during the course of the season. At the end of last year, we had Peter Moreland, Liam Hendricks, Travis Blackley, and Grant Balfour that were all on the major league level. We're kind of seeing things shake out during this off season. We'll see what happens come March. But we've got as many as 10 that have seen major league action over the last 2 years, which is good numbers. It really is.
Tom Nicholson is with us from Major League Baseball. And one of the big things that's happening in Australia, sporting-wise in 2014, is the fact that Major League Baseball, an actual 2 competition games coming to Australia, being played at one of the most famous sporting fields in the world, let alone Australia, and that's the Sydney Cricket Ground, in March next year. How did it happen? How did it come about?
Well, it actually was a process going all the way back to the 2000 Olympics. It's a cornerstone of what we do in our international department. So it is taking the game to other parts of the world. It is global in its reach and its focus. And you can't have any greater impact than to actually bring in an opening series, is what we call it. This is real deal. That we are opening our major league season here in Australia, and it has been a long time coming. We, at one stage, were looking and hopeful for Melbourne to get it. That was back in 2008, and then potentially in 12. And then, believe it or not, Sydney came through, fantastic offer, and to be able to play at the SCG. It's a beautiful, iconic stadium. Matter of fact, it's got history. And one of the turning points when we looked how to actually market this and make it a marquee event, a jewel event for us, was looking at the last time baseball was played was 1914, mm-hmm, against the New York Giants and the Chicago White Sox.
So was that an actual major league game, playing for points, as we would call it here?
I wouldn't say playing for points. Got to understand,
because
it took them forever to get here. They came by boat. So
it was an exhibition game.
It was an exhibition game.
Okay. You mentioned that, obviously, playing at the SCG, but this is something for anyone in Australia. This is not a once-in-a-lifetime chance, but it's a once-in-a-year chance, and maybe there'll be another one next year, maybe there won't. But if you want to see a major league game without going to the US, you've got to come to Sydney in March next year.
Exactly.
How often are major league games played outside the US and Canada?
We will have exhibition games, but usually an opening series of this nature is once every 4 years. So Tokyo had it in 2000, 04, 08, and 12. In 2012 was all played at the Tokyo Dome. We have had games in Puerto Rico, Mexico, but this is the first in the Southern Hemisphere.
Mm.
First ever. So it's remarkable, and yes, it is something that you can come and see the home game, home games of the Arizona Diamondbacks. We are actually taking 2 home games off of their schedule and playing them right here against the LA Dodgers.
So this is the first time played outside what might be described as a traditional baseball country, like Puerto Rico, Mexico.
Correct.
And Japan. So the Dodgers and the Diamondbacks. The Dodgers began in Brooklyn, moved out to Los Angeles, I think, in the late 50s, early 60s. Famous, famous team. Diamondbacks, much younger team, but already World Series winners very early on in their life. Tell me more about the Dodgers. Let's start with the Dodgers.
Dodgers have a new ownership group. Now, when you were telling the story about their history and background, it is storied. It is the O'Malley family really put it in a whole nother level as far as sporting franchises. It did go through a couple of sale changes.
Rupert Murdoch owned
including, it. Yeah, Fox or News. Yeah. They owned it for a short while. It is now part of Magic Johnson's consortium.
Mm-hmm. This was after a very messy divorce case.
Yes, for the previous owner. The McCourts, and that was unfortunately was aired through the media and the community. It was unfortunate, but I tell you what, the new ownership group. They understand the concept of international exposure. They are reaching out to the community throughout Southern California. I think they are doing a phenomenal job. And real exciting to have someone of the status and of Magic Johnson as part of that ownership
group. Will he be out here for the game?
He will be.
Wow, yeah. Okay.
Their whole ownership group will be.
And the Diamondbacks, the D-backs as they're known.
The D-backs, they were one of the youngest franchises ever to win the World Series.
It was a
fantastic effort. They have gone through a couple of changes, but that ownership group and their CEO, Derek Hall, they really have a fantastic culture amongst that organization. Derek Hall was just out here just recently and spoke to the NRL executives and was talking about the five aspects of their circle of success, business success. And it is a true culture that is top down and then back up. Just that culture about that organization is phenomenal.
So how was it decided that they would have the home game here in Australia? Why were the Diamondbacks involved?
Diamondbacks have always been very proactive on the international committee. Okay. And they've been looking for opportunities to explore. Yeah, they considered other offers, other countries, but as soon as Australia came on the agenda as a possibility, they were all over it. They said, what do we have to do to get this thing done? We want to be part of Australia.
Okay, so the two games, there are in fact more than two games, there are two competition matches, as we would call them, playing for points as part of the Major League Series. They are on what days?
22nd of March, Saturday evening, that will be the opening series. Followed by game two will be Sunday, the 23rd of March. It will be an afternoon game.
So there's a night game or an evening game followed by a day game the next day. Don't get much time to recover.
No, they don't. Yeah, understand that these players and the organizations, they're accustomed to playing day in, day out. I mean, they'll have a 162-game schedule between April and October. You're really looking at one day off per week, and that's usually a travel day. So,
and if you can't get to those games, there are a couple of trial matches or exhibition matches, and what's that going to involve?
We're calling it the challenge, and that's Team Australia. So we will have quite a few of our pros that will still be here that will be playing exhibition game against the Dodgers on the Thursday night, followed by Friday against that will be Team Australia versus the D-backs. Mm-hmm. And this gives both of the MLB teams an opportunity to see how the field plays, get through some of the nuances of this iconic stadium and get a feel for the field. It'll be good.
What is your measure of success with this idea?
We've got quite a few KPIs that we have against this, and it is part of our marketing strategic plan about having the great impact that this provides to a marketplace. We're hoping to get that exposure. The success really needs to be fully supported by Australia, the sporting community. It really is bums on seats. Mm-hmm. It's gone tremendously well as far as ticket sales. This once in a 100-year event, and people are embracing such an event. It's fantastic. So really, the short of it is, we want to see a packed stadium.
Okay, so a packed stadium, and you'd hope a couple of sparkling games of baseball. You don't want a boring 1-0 win or something like that. You actually want a pretty good game that people are going to get involved with.
We really do. Yeah, you know, and that's the fan experience. That's the engagement. There's one thing that you can't, it is that floating variable, is how the game goes. Once that game starts, it's really between the two teams. But I can guarantee you this, the two teams are arch rivals. Matter of fact, the day that we announced it here in Australia, June 13th, the night before was an all-in bench-clearing brawl between the two teams. There's really no love lost between these two. And the last time they played, the Dodgers clinched the National League Series in Arizona, and proceeded, after the stadium cleared, proceeded to enjoy the amenities, including the swimming pool in right field at the Diamondbacks. That is the last time they've seen each other in competition, and it'll be fun.
If you can guarantee a brawl, I think you'll have the Australian crowd on your side. It's a brilliant idea. I don't think it's going to be the last time. I don't know that we'll get it every year, but you'd have to hope every couple of years we could see something like this.
Oh, we do. We've got this on the radar for every 4 years. Mm-hmm. There's a good window for us, a good fit, because Tokyo certainly have been ingrained in hosting that opening series. But yes, that is another measure of our success, is being able to see this opening series come back. And Australia does a great job with welcoming foreigners and visitors. We've already seen that in the advance party trips that have come through. Australia does it well. As we know.
Thanks for coming in. It's a great idea. I hope it's a tremendous success. And Tom, thank you very much.
Rod, thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Tom Nicholson from Major League Baseball. We also heard from Suzanne Vega and Phoebe Panaritos. You've been listening to a special podcast of ABC Local Radio, The Nightlife.